I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of December. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. Our guest is Joan Walsh. She is editor-at-large of Salon.com, political analyst for MSNBC. Among her recent writings, The Whitewashing of Nelson Mandela's Legacy, as well as the role of the U.S. in supporting apartheid. How much progress have Republicans made in reaching out to women, young people, or Latinos? Obamacare seems to be recovering, albeit slowly. Kentuckians show when a state wants the program to work, it works. Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray are within sight of a deal that would keep the government open. And the president's speech on income inequality, the defining challenge of our time. Those are a few of the things that Joan has written about the last couple weeks. And there will be other issues we'll be discussing. Our phone number for your participation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We should also say that we like to announce when people have Wisconsin ties. Joan is a graduate of Shorewood High School in Wisconsin and also of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Joan, hello. Thanks so much for being with us again. How are you?
I'm fine, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. Well, as everybody is flying to South Africa, world leaders all over this planet, you wrote an interesting piece about the whitewashing of Nelson Mandela's legacy. How has it been whitewashed?
Well, I thought it was important in the wake of his death to make clear that while he was imprisoned, for much of the time he was imprisoned, much of the American right was really on the side of his jailers. You know, the African National Congress was tarred a communist group, and they did have some relationships with communist governments because they'd been shut out of relationships with the West. You know, they really were a casualty in the Cold War, where the perception was that the existing apartheid government was a strong bulwark against communism, and therefore anybody who wanted to topple it was allied with the communists. Well, that in a lot of countries was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because if you couldn't get help from the U.S. And its allies, then you sought help where you could get it, and that was often the Soviet Union. And so, you know, Ronald Reagan very much opposed lifting sanctions on South Africa. A quick side Wisconsin note, the University of Wisconsin was one of the first to divest from investing in South Africa. It was a very lively student movement in the mid to late 70s, and the Regents divested in, I believe it was 1978, and I covered that at the Daily Cardinal. So I was really aware of how long the fight went on and how much it took. It wasn't as easy in Congress as it was in Madison. A lot of people on even the contemporary right were very much opposed and really believed in keeping Mandela in prison.
Mm-hmm. And President Obama, was this the first movement that he became a significant part of, Joan?
Yes, he his very first public political act was at Occidental College in a protest against apartheid, and again a protest to demand that Occidental divest from its holdings in South Africa. So he remembered that on Wednesday night when Nelson Mandela passed, that this is the issue that galvanized him. And it galvanized a lot of us, a lot of people. You know, I've been really struck in the last week by the people talking about getting their start in that movement. For a lot of us who came of age in either the Carter presidency or the Reagan era, you know, it was a tough time to be a liberal. Liberals were kind of in retreat in a lot of ways. But the anti-apartheid movement really linked a new generation of student leaders and young progressives to a global movement for racial but also economic justice.
You do give a slight nod to Mitch McConnell and Newt Gingrich, who you say opposed Reagan and supported sanctions.
Yeah, I think it's important to do that. And Newt Gingrich, Mitch McConnell, said, you know, they tried hard to get Ronald Reagan to come over to their side, and they couldn't, and so they were going to go ahead and do it without him. And Newt Gingrich, likewise, voted against sanctions. And, you know, I'm not a huge Newt Gingrich fan, but in the last couple of days, he's been very outspoken in a great way in challenging some of the conservatives who continue to slur Nelson Mandela as a communist. You know, it's very tough to take in the man in his entirety, because he renounced violence eventually, but, you know, earlier in his career, he came to the conclusion that violence was the only option for liberation, but so did our founding fathers. Right. You know, this country was born out of violent revolution, and when you don't have democracy, there are very few options often. So, you know, merely attacking him as a terrorist or a communist because of the decisions he made, you know, Gingrich very aptly pointed out, you know, what would you do if you were being treated mm-hmm. that way and you had no recourse to reform?
Tell me about the enormity of his influence. It's interesting that so many presidents are going to South Africa, probably as we speak, that so many world leaders will be paying tribute to this man, that television is just flooded with tributes and documentaries. Why?
Because his message of transcendence and endurance and integrity and forgiveness, all those things together, it's almost like there's something for everyone. And I think that over time, as I said before, you know, we can't leave out that he was a revolutionary, but over time as a leader, he made a very powerful decision that, you know, white South Africans were part of South Africa, that he was not, they were not going to be scapegoated or tried. There was a truth and reconciliation process where they tried, you know, not to cover over apartheid era wrongdoing, to get at the truth, but also reconciliation was part of it. He was a left-leaning person, but believed that you could not simply nationalize or appropriate white-owned businesses, that the economic future of the country relied on people doing business there. It was increasing fairness, you know, making requirements and demands of them, but not outright making it hard to do business there. A lot of people, even, you know, conservative people, good capitalists, found ways to do business with Nelson Mandela. And I think that message of reconciliation and that reassurance to white South Africans was very powerful. And in a globe, on a planet that's really risen with racial and ethnic strife, and even in our country to this day, it has not fully reckoned with the division or the violence of our past, I think his message and his example were towering and important to just a great range of people.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to President Obama and his speech last week, which was really striking to you. I'm wondering why he gave it right now. And what it means for the president to speak. He hasn't done this too often. He did it, as you remind us, a couple of years ago. But he gave quite a speech on income inequality, the defining challenge of our time. What moved him to do that now, Joan?
I think he's really looking at his legacy, and I think he's aware that some of it's going to be controlled by obstructionists in Congress. He really has no control over whether immigration reform gets done on his watch. You know, some Senate Republicans have done their best. The House has bottled it up. There's really not a lot that he can do that requires legislation in this climate. If the 2014 midterm tilts us one way or another, that may change. But for now, I think his legacy is in large measure going to be determined in the way he frames the challenges facing this country going forward. And I think that there's a growing recognition, I think, even among some Republicans, that we have a real crisis, not merely of joblessness, j- joblessness is too high and the rate's coming down, but it's still too high. When you count all the discouraged workers and the people who've left the labor market, it's scary, actually. But there's another big problem, and that is increasingly a full-time job is not enough to lift you out of poverty, especially if you have a family. So you see this wave of fast food strikes. You see this wave of Walmart protests. You see this rising recognition that your and my tax dollars are actually going to pay for food stamps for McDonald's workers, for fast food workers, for bank tellers. There was a study last week that a third of all bank tellers, this is a booming industry with record profits, with paying its CEOs bonuses, but its bank tellers make so little that a third of them are on some kind of public assistance. And I think, you know, even as Republicans rail against the welfare state, we need to pay attention. We need to listen to them to some extent and say back to them, you know, this is happening in large measure because you can't support yourself and get out of poverty with a lot of salaries these days. So I think that the president, he's made speeches about the 99% and the 1% before. He's seen these. We've been talking about these trends for 5 or 6 years. But I think that it's a terrible shame that on his watch, it hasn't gotten any better, and in fact, it's gotten worse, at least under Bill Clinton. And I'm not blaming the president on this. These forces are sort of in charge, and with the Congress he has, there's not a lot he can do, but at least under President Clinton, income inequality lessened a little, not, it wasn't great, but the poor made progress under Bill Clinton, and they haven't under Barack Obama because of the political climate, as well as the consolidation of economic power.
Well, in the climate, you wrote an interesting piece about Democrats and how they seem to be split on this issue in terms of how we were framing it, that the fairness issue, which we're hearing now, has been framed as a loser, voters preferring to hear about opportunity. It turns out that maybe voters do want to hear about fairness.
Well, yeah, I think the election showed that. I wrote last week, you know, leave it to a pundit to get really excited about what, you know, what's going on in the world of punditry, okay? So I'm going to try to make this interesting to your audience. But there's a group called Third Way, and it's funded by a lot of investment bankers. It comes out of a real pro-Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. Which has a long history. You know, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, there was really a perception that the problem for the Democrats is that they've gone too far to the left, they were not friendly to business, and groups came along expressly designed to kind of pull the party to the center, which, you know, to my mind, served to pull it to the right, but we can quibble about that. But there really became this sense that the Democratic Party had to be identified with making businesses strong, and Wall Street was, you know, when Wall Street got rich, everybody got rich, and it did seem that way for a while, but that turned out not to be true. And so this group called Third Way wrote this very, very negative and damaging op-ed in the Wall Street Journal criticizing Elizabeth Warren and criticizing Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio of New York and saying that, you know, populism is a dead end for Democrats. And I wrote about how mistaken they were. They likewise said this, you know, that President Obama's message of fairness in the 2012 elections was a loser and that he was tilting too hard against, you know, Mitt Romney as a plutocrat and the face of investment banking. This was turning voters off. Well, of course, that's not true. And if it was true, you'd have me on your show debating President Romney's tax cuts for the wealthy, right? You know, so they've been proven wrong time after time. But there's a really different spirit afoot in the Democratic Party now, I think, and it's. You know, the public face is Elizabeth Warren, but we've got a lot of other, there are a lot of other people part of it. I'd count Tammy Baldwin there, certainly Russ Feingold, his independent group it came out immediately, to defend Elizabeth Warren and to, criticize this Third Way group. I think there's a lot of people going back to the president's speech on income inequality, realizing that the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party put in place a lot of policies that privileged the financial sector over other sectors, and really preached an austerity message that's been bad for the economy and bad for upward mobility. And so there's a battle right now for the soul of the Democratic Party. And it's heartening to me as a liberal to see liberals getting tough on this and not quailing and saying, oh, okay, well, we're just like Republicans too. And yes, let's cut Social Security and let's raise the age for Medicare eligibility, et cetera, et cetera. These Elizabeth Warren Democrats are saying, no, let's strengthen Social Security and maybe even make it more generous for the poorer seniors. There are alternatives to strengthen it besides cutting it.
I think the word you used was feistiness. The progressives have a bit of feistiness about them these days.
Yes, there's a feistiness. There's a whole range of people coming together behind this proposal to expand and extend Social Security, not cut it back, which, you know, that's always good. I've always thought it would be nice if progressives were out there, you know, with their own agenda rather than simply fighting to defend, but articulating why these programs work and how to make them stronger. You know, there will be a Social Security crisis in about 25 years if we don't do something to increase the share of income that's paid to Social Security. One way to do it, which Senator Obama way back when supported, but President Obama hasn't come out in favor of it, is to lift the cap. Right now, I think income as high as $110,000, I think, is subject to Social Security payroll taxes. You could take that higher and bring in more income to Social Security coffers. There's lots of things you can do besides cut benefits for the needy, but this is just one area. You know, I think there's a lot of agitation around a serious minimum wage hike. There's a lot of agitation around strengthening rights for low-wage workers. So I feel like it's not just talk, although there's a lot of talk. There are also an increasing number of proposals and a policy agenda to lessen income inequality and restore social mobility, which is really the heart of the American dream.
Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political this hour. She's editor-at-large for Salon.com, political analyst, MSNBC, author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And she is a graduate of Shorewood High School in Wisconsin and also UW-Madison, where she wrote about the issue of divestment for the Daily Cardinal in the 1970s. We are welcoming phone calls. We do want to let you know that our show on Wednesday at 1 o'clock will have a Nelson Mandela biographer with us, so we will talk about his life and legacy and whether or not we have whitewashed his history here in America on Wednesday of this week. So we'll talk about whatever you would like to discuss. We have yet to talk about health care. Is going a little bit better? Do you see the president addressing his legacy in a larger way when he talks about income inequality? What did you think of last week's speech? Well, we're going to go to phone calls, and we'll start taking them momentarily. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our program, I know you've been keeping track of the series. It's a year-long series in the New York Times. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is a doctor, and she's been looking at the cost of health care. The last piece that she did was on emergency rooms and how you can pay up to $500 per stitch. Sometimes it's not even a stitch. It's the glue stuff that they use to put your wound together. It's quite an article. Somebody ought to be looking at this, it seems to me, a little more thoroughly. But Elizabeth is doing a whippersnapper of a job. She will be with us hour two. She's a reporter and she's a doctor for the New York Times. All right, to your phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We start with Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Joan, I want to thank you very much for raising the point of these large corporations such as Walmart and McDonald's and so on paying their workers so little that they have to go on food stamps in order to make ends meet. My husband, I think, came up with a brilliant idea of a solution to that, which is if people are working full-time or whatever, for a corporation that is paying them so little that they have to go on food stamps, that the cost of those food stamps be charged back to the company that they're employed by.
I like that idea. I don't know where it would get in this Congress, but I think your husband is onto something. It really is.
I'm wondering if we get that idea out there, if we could build support for it.
Well, yeah, I think it would be great. There's probably a think tank or advocacy group out there working on this, but it would really be great to total up the costs that the federal and state governments, because it's certainly an issue on the state and local level too, are bearing because of these low wages. And count that as how do you make that a cost of doing business? Why is this acceptable? And these same people rail against the moochers and the 47%. A lot of that 47% are people who are on something called the earned income tax credit. That's another thing we're not even talking about. Now, I support the earned income tax credit. What it does is, if your wages fall below a certain level, you will get a tax credit, meaning a check, not merely, you'll get reduced taxes, sure, but you might even get a check back from the government if your wages are really low. But again, we're subsidizing low-wage employment, and I think that there's, certainly in my generation and older, there was an idea that, the minimum wage, that's just kids starting out, and they're going to rise. But what's happening is those jobs are held by grown-ups with families, and they're not, the wages aren't rising, and the people aren't rising out of them. So it would be great if we could start to total up the total costs that we are all paying to subsidize those low wages and take it out of their profits.
Thanks, Stella, for your call. Dean in Middleton, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for the awesome programming. I just have two questions for your guest. I myself am part of the generation that came of age right at the end of apartheid, so I remember the horrible video images on late TV news and then the process through reconciliation and Mandela's rise to the head of state of South Africa. The first question I have is, how much stock or how much weight should we give to these revelations, which to me are new, about Mandela's revolutionary communist-affiliated past? And the second question I had was, how would your guest assess his actual effectiveness as a head of state of South Africa in tackling problems like segregation, high rate of AIDS amongst the population, income inequality, so on and so forth? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Dean, thanks for the call.
Kathleen, he was breaking up a little, so I didn't fully hear the first question. On the second question, I think we have to talk about the fact that South Africa is still a terribly unequal country where, the white population still holds way disproportionate wealth. I mean, our white population does too, for that matter. But it's really just very, very lopsided in South Africa. Conditions, there certainly has been the development of a black middle class and a black upper middle class. But, in terms of making economic progress for the vast majority of Africans, black Africans, nearly enough hasn't been done. I think the real, where Mandela gets the credit, is holding the country together and preventing, an absolute bloodbath and a splintering that many people thought was inevitable, and it happened in other countries. There's still a whole lot left to do on the economic justice front.
Mm-hmm. In the first part, you've already covered that when he talked about his communist affiliation. We've already covered that some, and we will much more on Wednesday. So if we could just move on to other calls. Thank you, though, Dean, very much for your call. Let's go to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yep.
Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon.
Hi, your phone is kind of bad, so.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, the first question to put the guest on the spot. Is Hillary Clinton a dino, a Democrat in name only, such that she is so fully compromised by all the major wealth producers who are contributing to her campaign that she will never be able to initiate or pass any progressive legislation?
All right, Steve, thanks.
A dino is Democrat in name only for your listeners who don't know that particular acronym. You know, no, I don't think she is. I think Hillary Clinton has been a very strong and progressive voice for women. I would argue that during the 2008 campaign, her platform, her domestic platform anyway, was nominally more progressive than Senator Obama's. She came out for a mortgage foreclosure, which he did not. On the other hand, I understand completely what Steve is saying. I think that, you know, some of it, I have to say, we may all be a little guilty of either crediting or blaming her for things that her husband did on the economic front. Bill Clinton did help lift people out of poverty. He expanded that earned income tax credit that I talked to you about before. But at the same time, you know, he ended Glass-Steagall restrictions on banks and helped usher in the great fleecing of our society and our economy that took place after those regulations were lifted. Really can't blame Hillary Clinton for that. If she, you know, we've got to take her on her merits looking forward. I think she sees the importance of income inequality as an issue. I think she has progressive tendencies, but I think the best thing to do, you know, is to focus on the 2014 election and make sure that there are more Elizabeth Warrens in Congress to push forward President Hillary Clinton or President Joe Biden or, you know, whoever it may be. I think that one thing that progressives do too much of is focus on, you know, every 4 years the big question of who's going to run for president, and not enough on our local assembly and state senate races, and Congress. The best way to get a progressive president, I believe, is to give her or him a more progressive Congress.
Let's talk a little bit about health care. Signs are that it's much, much easier to get on the exchange. From what I've been reading, and you have, I'm sure, as well, Joan, there is some concern about whether or not the information is getting to the insurance companies without errors, and whether or not there are going to be a whole bunch of people come January 1st who believe they have signed up for the exchange, but the information hasn't been translated properly. Are there valid concerns about that, or do you think the administration is trying to work that out and can in the next 3 weeks?
Well, I think, yes, there are valid concerns, and yes, they can be worked out. There is this, what they call, back-end issues. And I think that, you know, individual policyholders, as well as the web of navigators and insurance companies themselves, are going to have to, you know, put a little bit of extra muscle into quality assurance and making sure that you know, everything people think has been done, it has really been done. But I think overall the picture is much brighter, both on the exchanges as well as in the individual states where, you know, mainly with Democratic governors that really wanted this to work and put money and muscle and political power into making it work. I think the rate of sign-up is much quicker. We've also got, you know, people finding out about their eligibility for Medicaid expansion, and then the tragedy of the Republican governors who refused to take what is 100% funding for the first 3 years and 90% after that, federal funding for new Medicaid clients. Again, we're talking about low-wage people. But, you know, a lot of Republican governors turned down that money. I predict that in the next few months, you're going to see a lot more political pressure on those governors. And some of them, at least, will break down and take the money and begin enrolling their people in that expanded Medicaid. Because not only is it good for those families, it's good for the economy. It's certainly good for local hospitals. So I think, you know, there are going to continue to be glitches and hitches, and it's a massive undertaking, but I think that it's gotten much better. And, you know, journalists are really good at sort of
finding, we like to cover problems. We don't like to cover, hey, everything went well. That's not news. But I think that getting the stories out there about people who've never been insured before and fight because of some pre-existing condition or else because they just couldn't afford it, having coverage, we're seeing many more of those stories, and they may come to dominate the narrative in the months to come.
You mentioned Alan Grayson in one of your columns talking about an expansion of Medicare. Rather, do you think that we're going to see a time when that will be a public option as part of health care reform, that if you want a Medicare at, well, starting with 55 and up, that'd be great, or maybe eventually for everybody?
You know, it should have been, and it should be. And to go back to what we were saying before, Kathleen, I think it's great the progressive Democrats like Alan Grayson, are starting to spell out, hey, here's a real option. Because, you know, there was a very wonky debate back in 2009 about the so-called public option for health insurance. And really, what it was never fleshed out how it would work. Insurance companies and their friends in Congress were very quick to squash it. And you know, I think that the administration traded it away as an option very early. But really what it would have said would have been, in its best form, really, it would have been, you know, you're listening to some of these stories. There are stories of people who are not getting affordable insurance, but yet they're not eligible for a subsidy. And they might be, a lot of these are going to be in states where there's not a lot of competition, where one or two big insurance companies dominate the market. What those of us who favored a, quote, public option thought was, okay, for those people, they should be able to buy into. We're talking about spending their own money now. These are the people we're talking about. They should be able to take their own money and buy into a public plan that has lower overhead costs and that is cost-effective, nationwide, has already an existing network of doctors. It should be an option. I thought, aren't, you know, conservatives for choice? It should have been, and it should be an option. And you may find down the road that especially in states where there is near monopoly on insurance, that there's more pressure to do that. It makes perfect sense. And especially getting that 55 and older mix into Medicare, it would be good for Medicare because those are the healthy people, you know, in the Medicare pool, as opposed to those are the older and somewhat sicker people in the normal insurance pool. So it's such a smart idea. It would work so well and solve so many different problems. But, you know, the stranglehold of insurance companies made sure it wasn't even on the table in 2009. Thanks to Alan Grayson and the Progressive Caucus and other groups. It's getting another hearing. Is it going to happen next year? No. But could it happen in 2016 or 2018? It could.
Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. One line is open right now. Also, feel free to leave messages because we love reading them on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or here on our email, which is talk@wpr.org. Ray in Rhinelander, hi.
Hello, I want to compliment both of you. Thank you for having this presentation on. And your speaker definitely has done her homework and research from Nelson Mandela all the way down. I just want to make a comment here. It's really interesting. You know, when I was, I'm in my 60s. I was born and raised around Milwaukee. I don't live there anymore. But I remember back then, and I know that's back then, but I'm leading up to the minimum wage here. It won't take long. The whole thing is even the car washers back then, they made the hand-held car washers who paid $1.10 an hour, they had health insurance. Everybody had access to health insurance. Everybody had opportunities. So here we are going through the years and years of variety of different circumstances in our country, and we're at this position now where people need assistance. That is just a mathematical fact. It has nothing to do with emotional losers or on the dole or anything. It's a mathematical fact. You talk to anybody in any town, even in the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin, where people want to improve their lives, they're struggling, and they need assistance. So, yes, we need to raise the minimum wage. You know, and one other quick comment is Should the rich pay more? I think everybody should pay a flat 10% on your gross at the end of the year. Everyone, you know, and just leave it at that. They'd have so much money they wouldn't know what to do. But, you know, this isn't an ideal world, and things aren't working all what we'd like. But the fact remains is that there are figures, there are things going on that show why we need to do something and why people need food stamps and why they need assistance. It's just a fact.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for your call. Did you write about this or did somebody else write about the fact that there seems to be less Republican resistance to raising the minimum wage? Do you think this is a possibility that $10 an hour really is something that we could deal with?
I think it is a possibility. I think there is a growing consensus that includes Republicans that we need to do this. But you know what happens is you've got a lot of Republicans. You still have a lot of moderate Republicans who can come together with Democrats around a few common sense solutions, and yet they wind up being isolated by Tea Party Republicans who have a complete free market orientation, and then, you know, John Boehner and the House leadership are more afraid of their Tea Party caucus than they are of their moderate caucus. And, you know, the simple thing on a lot of issues going down the line would be for John Boehner to hold a vote on various things, including the minimum wage, and you'd have, you know, a majority or unanimous support among Democrats and enough Republican votes to pass the House. But on, you know, time and time again, he refuses to do that, and so good ideas get bottled up.
More phone calls in a moment. Joan Walsh is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joan is editor at large for Salon, and she is on MSNBC as a political commentator frequently. She's the author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. And she is a strong Wisconsin ties, UW graduate and Shorewood High School graduate. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joan Walsh with us this hour. We have one line open if you'd like to join our All Things Political conversation. Carl is our next caller in Mexico. Are you in Mexico?
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Carl. Are you in Mexico?
Yeah, okay. I heard a noise there. I thought maybe I got cut off after waiting. Yeah, yes.
Okay.
That's right. I'm an internet listener.
Oh, great.
I wanted to break up a point that's often missed. More often than not missed is that there's a difference between state minimum wage and federal minimum wage. Most state state minimum wages are higher than the federal, and federal minimum wage only applies to national companies or interstate companies or businesses that do interstate business. So my family had a farm in Minnesota, but their marketing was in New York. As a result, they were hit by the federal minimum wage instead of the state minimum wage. So it's very important that be brought up in conversation, that difference. Also, because you're talking about all political, the Medicare, if you are a U.S. citizen under the officially, okay, here comes Medicare. If you live out of the country, you are eligible for the taxation for Medicare, but you're not eligible for the benefits on Medicare if you live out of the country. There you go.
How are you making your income? From a company in the United States?
I do what I can, but I live out of the country.
You live out of the country.
I'm eligible for the Medicare taxation, but I'm not eligible to use it.
Right, because you don't live in America?
I live in America, but I don't live in the USA.
I am a little confused here. Joan, maybe you're not confused and can help me here.
Well, Mexico is part of the Americas, but not part of the United States. So
right.
I was not familiar with that. I think that's the point he's making. But I was not familiar with that. But I guess it makes sense. How would they have a network of doctors
right.
Globally to take care of you? So it's one of those little gray areas people can fall into.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is if you're an American and you're in a foreign country, many foreign countries, and you get hurt in some way, you go to the doctor and you walk out with no bill.
Yes, I know. I've gotten sick in Mexico and had that happen to me. So I guess if you live there, that doesn't happen to you. But anyway, yes, I guess that's a problem.
Yeah. All right, let's go next to Farah in Sussex. Hi.
Hi there. We were speaking a little bit about Social Security and enhanced benefits, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm a very big proponent of a living wage and of our benefits for people, but I think being a realist and a business person, which I am, it's pretty obvious that, we need to push back the retirement age for Social Security benefits and probably the age that we can all start receiving Medicare benefits. And I don't hear a lot of chatter about that. And I think, I'm guessing, my guess is, totally uneducated guess, that it's because it's politically extremely unpopular. But like I said, as a realist, I think it's inevitable. And I just wanted your comments on that. As far as, I'm not an actuarial, but it makes a lot of sense that that's probably what we're going to have to do in this country, considering that when Social Security was initially, introduced, people didn't live to be, the average person didn't live to be 86 years old, but they do today. I don't think the intention was that we would live 20 years on Social Security. And so, I think if we want to continue to have our contributions similar to what they are today, it doesn't take an actuarial to figure out we probably either can't retire when we do now or we need to contribute more. And I just wanted your feedback on that.
So when do you think we should, Farah, when do you think we should retire?
Well, people nowadays, or give an incentive for people to work. My folks are 67 and 66, and they're both still working and love working. They've always, they're educated people. They haven't had to have a physical labor job, and I understand that is a difference as well. But I think 70, easily. People are very sharp nowadays, and I think they enjoy their careers.
Joan?
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out the fact that, your folks are not working at manual labor, because I think the world is divided into people who are very sharp and enjoy their careers and, sit at a desk or do something creative, and people who dig ditches and drive trucks and, work behind counters and they're on their feet all day, and that, the world is very different in different jobs. In terms of raising the age, but we did raise the retirement age, and we create incentives for people to stay employed to age 70. And probably over time, we may do that again as life expectancy continues to grow. But it's got to be done in a way to protect low wage people, and again, people who work at manual labor, because our body, we may have extended our lifespans, but we haven't necessarily extended the capacity of our bodies to do certain mm-hmm. kinds of things. And the other thing is, the raising the age of Medicare eligibility has been discussed many times, and it's been studied by the Congressional Budget Office and other places. It doesn't save money. It saves the federal government a little bit of money, but it creates costs at the state level and certainly for individuals. It's really a terrible idea. And in fact, what it does, once again, is take the healthiest people out of the Medicare pool, because the younger, by and large, the younger people are the healthier people. So the 65 and 66 and 67-year-olds who would theoretically come out, they are hard hit by the cost to them. Their employers, if they're still employed, are hit. States are hit, but it doesn't wind up saving Medicare a lot of money. And when they do get to Medicare, those who are not covered, who didn't get insurance, are sicker and immediately cost the government more. So actually, it's this kind of weird shell game that doesn't save money. And it, that that's an area, as we said before, where we should be encouraging, we should be making it possible for people, especially in that 55 to 65 age group, to pay into the system, pay more, pay for it, but become part of that pool.
Thanks for the call. Representative Paul Ryan, Senator Patty Murray, within sight of a deal that would keep the government open. Are you optimistic?
It's hard for me to be optimistic given the control of the Tea Party caucus in the House. And, you know, it's a positive thing that they're still talking, and I believe that they're talking in good faith. There are so many things that could happen that could scuttle this deal. You know, Democrats are insisting that money is not only, that the sequester is reduced and that the budget, the final budget number is higher than the sequester level. A lot of Republicans, including Mitch McConnell over in the Senate, have said, no, the sequester is practically written in stone. It's the law of the land, even though it was only put in as the law of the land in order to force a better budget deal. It was never intended to be the permanent budget line. But, you know, they're talking, but there are still lots of stumbling blocks, so I wouldn't bet on it.
Karen is our next caller in Hillsboro. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have several points to make. First of all, with the Walmart food stamp thing, what's to prevent them from just firing people when they find out they go on food stamps, you know, and rehiring somebody else just as poor, and as soon as they go on food stamps, you fire them. Now, as far as Social Security and their insolvency, it was my understanding that Bush's tax refunds, those checks some of us got, came out of raiding the Social Security Fund, and the Social Security Fund was raided to pay for the Vietnam War. Maybe we should put that money back.
Joan.
Yeah, I mean, supposedly that money is all going to be put back, but, you know, but it's very complicated. They have used it for things it shouldn't have been used for. You know, Democrats have tried to keep it sacrosanct but haven't. You know, there are certainly problems with it. But the idea that we're going to be in some kind of imminent crisis, that is not true. And there are solutions that don't involve, you know, massive cutbacks to people or keeping people who would have a hard time working to age 70 or 72.
I wanted to spend just a few moments, because we have about a minute left, talking about the Republicans' efforts to widen the number of people who would vote for them, to recruit young people, to recruit minorities. You've written about that recently. Have they made such efforts, Joan?
No, I really would have to argue that they have not. You know, I think that when Reince Priebus came out with his, quote, autopsy, looking at what happened in 2012, that happened at the beginning of this year, he said they couldn't afford to be the party of stuffy old men, and that they needed to reach out to women and young people and Latinos in particular. The only policy prescription that was in the autopsy was some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. They had not moved on that. The Senate did. The House did not. You know, in terms of women, I think, you know, they tried to publicize. They tried to make it a bad thing that the Affordable Care Act now mandates maternity coverage. You know, I don't think that they've done anything to make inroads with young people. They're really, you know, to the extent they've had a good month in terms of polling, it's because of these stumbles of Obamacare. So that you've seen young people and you've seen women slide a little bit away from the Democrats. I can't deny that that's happening, but it's not due to anything Republicans have done to lure them. And in fact, you know, this whole Affordable Care Act mess has really distracted Republicans from their demographic collision course and may turn out to be a bad thing in the end because they've done absolutely nothing to reach out to different groups.
Joan, thank you ever so much for being with us. We'll see you in print and on TV.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Joan Walsh, our guest, editor-at-large, Salon.com, political analyst for MSNBC, and author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the program, Robin Cherry for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We do all things political Monday, every Monday at 1 o'clock. A reminder, we started today with Nelson Mandela, and I know there's been a lot of coverage about him. We want you to have a chance to talk about his life. That will be Wednesday at 1. We'll talk to a biographer.